Okay, welcome back to another episode of More from Sam, Thanksgiving edition, which really doesn't mean anything. It just means happy Thanksgiving to everybody. And if you're not in the U.S., it just means happy third week of November. Hi, Sam. How are you?
Good, good. Good to see you.
Yeah, good to see you. It was great seeing you in Chicago last week. I have to say that was by far my favorite show of yours thus far.
Yeah, that was fun. It was a great venue, and we had some friends there. It was really, it was a blast.
Yeah, it felt like it's about 20% different than the one you started with in Chicago.
Yeah. Yeah, I keep revising it as things come into the news and drop out, so yeah.
Yeah, it's getting a little tighter as you go, too, so
yeah,
it's enjoyable to watch
I'm
that go.
Starting to know what I think, apparently.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you had your first heckler, too, which was...
Did that, you know, honestly, that is... It's possible that's the second heckler ever. I mean, it's the first legit heckler. I had something close to that before, but this is a person who actually had to be escorted out. You know,
I did not know until yesterday what her position was. Do you think you know?
Well, clearly she didn't like something I said about Islam. I'm not quite sure how far that ran, but that was the point of contention. That's when she shrieked bullshit. I happen to be on that topic, so.
Okay, but I was guessing the wrong side. She was actually more to the right.
No.
Yes. No.
One is very hard to get to the right of me on this particular point.
Well, she yelled out bullshit when you said that Islam is a religion of peace. I don't know what her position was, but it seemed like she yelled it right at that. Okay.
But pretty clearly, I was calling bullshit on that concept, right? So. And I think that was unmistakable, the line I was taking. There's no way she was to the right of me.
Okay, yeah. I originally thought that, I mean, being there, I thought that was the position. But informed yesterday that, no, I'd gotten it wrong. Either way, we had great security there. So they had her removed immediately. But for anyone else who would like to see you perform live and not yell anything out, we have 9 shows coming up for 2026. Just quickly, it's Los Angeles, Dallas, Austin, Portland, Vancouver, Palm Beach, Toronto, D.C., and New York City again. Any words for the people of Portland, Sam?
What is happening in Portland? Yeah, it's interesting to, you put these tickets on sale in multiple cities, and there's just a radical difference in specific cities. I mean, it's like New York sells out in, I don't know, a day, or virtually sells out in a day. I mean, literally like 2 hours, we're in 80% sold or something. And, Portland, it remains to be seen whether that's actually going to work, right? I don't know what I did to Portland, but the people are not coming out, and you just never really know what's going to happen when you put tickets on sale. I mean, usually it's not a disappointment, but occasionally there's a city where something has not gone well with me in that audience. So yeah, if you don't come out, we will cancel Portland. And we will not lie about why we canceled it. We will say that we didn't sell enough tickets in Portland, if that's what happens.
Right. But, every other act will say something like, due to unforeseen circumstances. Yeah. Ours is due to unforeseen circumstances.
Yeah, force majeure here is the people in Portland didn't buy enough tickets. So we'll see what happens.
All right, Portland, you've been warned. Get your friends, buy tickets, or you may not see Sam. All right, on to our first topic. I want to talk about, I've seen many different reactions to Marjorie Taylor Greene, her apology for the role she's played in divisive politics. And I wanted to get your reaction.
Well, honestly, I didn't see her apology. It was an apology video that she made?
She was talking to Dana Bash, and she was pretty apologetic about,
right.
You know, she acknowledged that she had played a role. Dana had called her out.
Yeah, I mean, that's always nice to hear. I mean, she's been so crazy that I just don't know how rehabilitated she could conceivably be. I mean, she was out there with Jewish space lasers and QAnon, and it's hard to exaggerate. It's actually impossible to exaggerate how crazy she's been. So, I mean, she was right in the Candace Owens orbit with just everything's a conspiracy, and there's nothing so bizarre that she didn't have a taste for it, at least. So, yeah, I mean, if she's had a reboot of her brain and is thinking rational thoughts and has now gotten out of politics for the moment because it's become so toxic for her, having gotten out of stride with Trump. I mean, that's kind of interesting, but I have no confidence that people change that fundamentally, especially not in a short news cycle. So I think we're going to get some more crazy from her. That'd be very surprising if we don't.
Well, it reminded me when I was watching her, she seemed entirely normal in that clip for 6 minutes. And it reminded me of when I watched Matt Gaetz. I don't know if you remember seeing him on Club Random with Bill Maher.
Mm-hmm.
He seemed entirely normal too. What do you make of this? These people present as crazy, but when they're in, they can find moments of sanity. Is it a show?
Yeah, I think there are people who are, this is a huge problem. It extends obviously beyond these people, I mean, to many, many people in politics and public life at the moment, where you have very talented performers on some level who, if I had to summarize the character defect, it's that they have no principles, or they have a serious software flaw, which is in many cases a just kind of a ravenous appetite for the contrarian take on everything, which then summates as, you know, just one conspiracy theory after another is entertained and halfway believed or fully embraced, and there's no limit to it. So that, I mean, that's what we're seeing a lot of. But there are a bunch of people out there who I think are probably diagnosable as psychopaths. I mean, I think they just have no real empathy for people, and they're manipulators, and they're charismatic, and they're good at what they do, and they're unhindered by any kind of moral compunction while doing it. I mean, Trump is certainly this type of character. I mean, you know, he cannot be embarrassed by being caught in a lie or being shown to have contradicted himself. I mean, all he can do, I mean, I guess he can become enraged by some bad press, but I mean, there's no conscience there that ever gets appealed to, right? I mean, none of these people ever apologize. They don't correct errors. They don't acknowledge fault. They don't think better of anything. I mean, they just keep pivoting. I mean, even if they change views or change policies or change direction, they pivot, but it's unacknowledged. And they have absolutely no, I mean, take Elon in this case, right? Elon has now sidled up to Trump like a beggar once again, right? He went to the MBS dinner and took whatever crumbs from the table he could be given. I mean, it's just a completely pathetic picture. But why is it so pathetic? Because here's somebody who went to war with Trump, calling him a pedophile, effectively, in so many words, basically saying, this man is criminally culpable for his entanglement with Jeffrey Epstein. That's why, these files haven't come out, and they're going to come out and destroy him, right? Basically, he took as hard a swing as possible at the character of the president. He's offered absolutely no rational accounting of how his opinion of Trump has changed. And yet now he's back just begging him for attention and favor. Clearly, he isn't made sick by this process, right? He doesn't even see that it's done anything to his reputation, right? He's just operating. Honestly, I just don't know what you have to have in place or have to be missing, you know, cognitively and emotionally to be able to perform like that. But it's unimaginable to me that, like, if I were going to suddenly change my tune on Trump and not have to acknowledge why, right? Just start praising Trump and wanting to be his friend. And I mean, just imagine that. Imagine that in front of my audience. Just like, okay, like I'm all full MAGA now. Trump is the greatest president we've had, but there's nothing to account for, right? I mean, it's just like, I don't know how these people become these type of people. But just look at the people who have accomplished these kinds of, you know, pivots. I mean, Elon's is the most egregious it's impossible to even interpret, because why would he have to do this, right? He's the richest man on earth. His businesses are going fine, or they're doing whatever they're doing. He doesn't need Trump he can just keep doing his thing. He could have stayed with Trump as a pedophile, and this bill is an abomination. And go fuck yourself. And he could have had the integrity of that epiphany. But no, he's back, you know, just being a sycophant mode. Why? Right. And how? I mean, the why is inscrutable. The how is impossible for me to understand.
Well, Elon strikes me as somebody who's probably more or less the same on stage and off stage. Whereas Matt Gaetz and Marjorie Taylor Greene and even Trump, it feels like the costume comes off, they get off stage, and they're a different person. Like, it's a show. And I think there's something different about that.
Well, we know these people are liars, right? I mean, Elon is he seems to be a compulsive liar to me at this point. So he can't be the same on stage and off stage because he's lying a lot. We know Tucker Carlson has been lying about his views. I mean, that was one product of the Dominion lawsuit, that his private texts were leaked. And we know that he had been, you know, wishing for Trump to disappear for quite some time and calling him a demonic force and said he couldn't wait to be rid of him, et cetera. We know he didn't believe in the 2020 election was stolen, and he'd been pushing all that. So he's a hypocrite and a liar, but he's functioning in a space where none of that matters, right? He's cultivated an audience that is not disposed to keep score in any way. They're just on to the next thing, right? You know, just the next bright, shiny object of conspiracism or innuendo or you know, smearing of political opponents or whatever it is. But they know, these people understand their audiences, and they understand how little they need to do to maintain their reputation in front of those audiences.
Right. I want to switch gears. I think it was about 2 days after your most recent episode on Trigonometry podcast that I noticed you getting slammed online. And by the time I noticed, it was sort of
over. I got slammed online? Is that?
Exactly.
What a surprise.
But this is what I was going to say, is I feel like because I didn't know about it in real time, that it never really happened. And I want to know, is this what it's like to be off social media these days?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I don't know about it unless it's been sent to me by you or somebody else who noticed it. But yeah, no, it's amazing. If you weren't paying attention, there's not that many. I can count on one hand or maybe three fingers of one hand the people who will send me stuff that happens on X or Reddit or, yeah. And so in this case, it was Elon slamming me on X. And so you would think that would matter. If being slammed on X matters, you'd think Elon doing it would matter.
Multiple times.
It doesn't. It's amazing. I mean, again, I'm reluctant to make too much of this all the while celebrating it, because I realize there are people with certain kinds of careers or jobs where being slammed by, you know, someone even much less of a platform than Elon's on X might matter to them, right? I mean, I think it's very easy for me to say Twitter is in real life, but I think for many people it might still be. But man, it just doesn't exist for me. It's just amazing how much it doesn't exist.
Well, you're very lucky to have a great group of subscribers and supporters that are supporting you, paying you to be this voice in the world, and so you do have a great audience.
Oh, yeah. But I mean, even like at this point, it's just like, even if my audience were very different, it's still hard to see how it would matter. I mean, I guess the way it matters is if something gets ginned up against you and your employer can still get, you know, worried about the backlash on social media, and then you can get fired. I mean, I think that is probably still happening in some media space. I think it probably has to happen still more from the left than from the right, but it's just amazing not to have my mind polluted by any of it. I mean, I can still remember what it was like to feel like I had to respond. I mean, obviously on X when I was, or on Twitter when I was on Twitter, but on the podcast, and I would just get these cycles of kind of needless controversy that was all. I mean, it took me years to realize that, for me at least, none of it would exist but for my engagement on Twitter. I mean, I just wouldn't, you know, the Ezra Klein thing, that was all Twitter. Yeah, I mean, I guess I'm not really given to regret very much, but if I regret anything, I regret it taking me that long to realize that I had invited this sort of river of digital sludge into my life, and then spent an immense amount of time trying to figure out how to keep my life clean, not realizing that I could just turn off the tap. And yeah, it took years, but here we are.
Well, you're one of the rare few that was getting canceled when it was Twitter, and now canceled when it's X.
Right.
Doesn't matter for you.
From each direction, yeah.
Yeah, never go back on. Everyone listening to this podcast has won some number of lotteries, whether it's with their health, family, financial, or in many other arenas. And given your belief around the myth of the self-made man, why do you think we struggle so much to craft a society that takes care of the versions of ourselves that could have just as easily not won some of these lotteries?
We don't craft such a society.
We don't. Right. Why is it so hard? Why are we not able to put ourselves in the positions of having not won
the lotteries? I'm going to praise the audience if they can understand that question. But basically, you're saying that many of us have won the lottery, and we don't recognize just how much luck is involved in us having what we have, even our talents that we've made the most of. And we're not nearly as compassionate as we should be, given the role that luck is playing in the unequal success of people in our society.
That's right. Thank you for restating that question for me. Yeah.
Okay. So it's a question about compassion and irrational understanding of just how unfair life is. Yeah, I don't think we're, I mean, just look at, I mean, take the problem of homelessness, right? I mean, we all find it galling, and we find that, you know, if you're living in a major city in America, our complete failure to respond to this problem in a sane way. And I mean, it's obviously a very difficult problem to solve, but the thing you know, drug abuse aside, when you just look at the component of mental illness here, and you see, you know, you're walking on the sidewalk and you see someone who's obviously been living on the streets forever, you know, ranting to invisible enemies. I mean, how you can't feel in your bones the role that luck has played in differentiating you from this person, right? I mean, the fact that you don't have the brain chemistry that has pitched you into that hellscape, it's pure luck. I mean, no, literally no one can take credit for not being floridly schizophrenic. I mean, the only sane response is compassion on some level. I mean, yes, fear is also understandable. Annoyance that we haven't figured out how to keep people suffering this kind of mental illness off the front steps of the restaurant we're trying to walk into. I mean, it's just like, obviously that's not this, it's idiot compassion that suggests that someone should be free to live out their dysfunction on the sidewalk. Whatever services exist should be given to these people, and they should be given to them someplace where they can actually receive them. So I'm not saying that anything like the status quo of just tolerating this is compassion, but compassion really is the only sane response to this. I mean, just there, but for the grace of the great roulette wheel of the galaxy, go all of us. And it's, yeah, I mean, I just, Elon's another example of just somebody whose ethics seems entirely framed by utterances like, I wasn't given anything. I did everything myself. And when you think of the shit that President Obama got when he said in Silicon Valley, you know, you didn't build this, this being all of the infrastructure that has made it possible for there to be a Silicon Valley in America, it's the ethical intuitions of adolescence to not acknowledge the role of luck and the gratitude for all that has been built before you arrived on the scene, right? And all the investment that was required to create a canvas for you to work on. Anyone who's not kind of vividly aware of that is just lost ethically, I think.
Yeah, I mean, going back to the question that wasn't crafted perfectly or beautifully, if you recognize that you walk around, you see people with some disorders of some kind, and you recognize that, as you said, it's the roulette wheel, we just got lucky. I think it's obviously compassion, but there's something more to that, that it would be great to see people want to see themselves in that potentially and say, that could have just as easily been me. That child could have just as easily been mine, and want to create a society that would at least make sure those people have the basic needs. Today we have the resources to solve these problems.
Well, that would be the effective implementation of compassion, right? And I mean, just like, if it happened to your friend, you'd want to figure out how to help your friend, right? And to realize that everyone is potentially a friend or a friend of a friend or even yourself. I mean, but for the good luck you enjoy. I mean, it's just, there's something so short-sighted. It's understandable that most people don't have, I mean, they don't feel implicated in the decisions that would effectively change any of this. But the thing I can't get my head around is just the extraordinarily wealthy people who don't feel they have a stake in this stuff. Right, and they don't want to allocate any funds toward helping it. I mean, like that. If they just spent half the amount of time they spend trying to pay the legal minimum of taxes, right? I mean, all of the effort that goes into just finding the next loophole in the most recent change in the tax code, if half of that intelligence were focused on how to help the least fortunate people in our society, we would live in a much better society and everyone would have a better life for it, right? I mean, it's just like, you just can't privatize, no matter how wealthy you are, you can't privatize everything, right? And if you could, you'd be in a sort of prison of wealthy solitude. We want public spaces that are beautiful and functional, right? No matter at any level of wealth, we should want that. And we want other people who are not nearly as wealthy enjoying those spaces, right? And so, yes, we have to figure out how to deal with a 1% rate of schizophrenia in every metropolis. And you stack upon that the other causes of homelessness, substance abuse and lack of affordable housing and just, intermittent bad luck. I mean, a lot of people who are homeless are only homeless for like a month, right? I mean, we have to catch all these people and help them. And so it is with differential luck with respect to health and everything else. I mean, it's just, I don't know. I mean, I think this current batch of super wealthy people have distinguished themselves for a lack of commitment to the common good. And I mean, you just look at this, the race toward AI and the build out, the multi-hundred billion dollar build out, right? I mean, it's just like, look at how motivated we can be by the prospect of making money, right? I mean, just if we can have 1/10 the motivation at the prospect of actually helping people, our world would be transformed.
But you don't think AI is going to help people and that a lot of that's baked in, that they think that...
Yeah, but that's not the motivation. This race, the arms race is not being propelled by, oh my God, we're going to be able to help so many people, let's just get there as fast as possible. No, the arms race is being propelled by financial interest and fear. I mean, part of it is just fear, but it's just not... I mean, compassion is is not a fuel that human engines can use, or it doesn't burn nearly as bright as other incentives.
Okay, shifting topics. One of your subscribers credits you with freeing him from his anti-Semitism, is wondering if you have a theory of mind for what allows people to let go of deeply held beliefs.
I don't know if there's more information on that point. I mean, I don't know what I would have said that would have helped there, or how that person was locked in. Or if it's just my sterling example as a Jew.
I believe he wrote an article on it somewhere, but I didn't bring that to you. You're just gonna have to guess, Sam.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I just think, I mean, beliefs are quite vulnerable to disconfirmation. I mean, it's very simple. It's like, insofar as your belief makes any contact with the real world, it doesn't take much to show it to be false if it is in fact false, right? And then the question is, do you care, right? Or are you going to just pivot and, ignore this contradiction in your worldview? I mean, people have beliefs that contradict other beliefs that they hold just as tightly, right? So you can just be led into contradiction with yourself. And then, something's got to give, or you, again, we have this capacity to just move on and pretend that nothing's happened and ignore that part of our worldview. But
I think logically that makes sense, but experientially for myself, it didn't matter what you would have said. When I was a practicing Jew and you were going to talk to me about something, there was just no way you were going to penetrate my mind. I just wasn't open. Persuasion is probably only possible if somebody's ready, would be my guess, but I don't know. I wasn't.
I do think that the most persuasive move is to show that someone's in contradiction with themselves, right? So like if, they're claiming to want to move left and claiming to want to move right, and you can show them that becomes, it becomes untenable in a way that being in contradiction with the world is, not as persuasive, right? They can pretend, they can avert their eyes from the world. They can't really avert their eyes from wanting A and wanting B and those being in contradiction. But
I did for well over a decade, was fully aware of it. And I think many in your audience also have a lot of gratitude to you. I don't know that you helped me get out, but certainly when I arrived, you were on the other side, making a lot of sense. So speaking of people with deeply held beliefs, I had so many people reach out to me with nearly the same comment. And speaking of deeply held beliefs, I had so many people reach out to me with nearly the same comment about the Doug Wilson podcast. It was as though that you had either captured an alien or had discovered an animal in the wild that was formerly believed to be extinct. And we got to be a fly on the wall as you spent time with it. And one of your subscribers wants to know what was going through your head during and after your conversation with him. And they said, look, I understand you may not want to reveal it, but they're dying to know, Sam. Mm-hmm. So if you could share.
The one thing I didn't anticipate about that is that we were going to have to jailbreak it, because the first hour really served as kind of the most, anodyne showcasing of his views without any pushback from me. So it just seemed like almost like an onboarding to his worldview, that somebody said this was just kind of socially irresponsible to just put this out without the second hour. So we very quickly agreed to that. And that I hadn't anticipated. I didn't know how the conversation was going to go, but I knew that he was almost certainly going to just check the boxes, you know, the biblical boxes provided without apology, right? I knew that I could just walk him into what was in the Bible, and he wasn't going to pretend that it wasn't there or to have some, you know, allegorical gloss on it that took the crazy out of it. So that, you know, and I actually respect that more than I respect all the various flavors of religious moderation that essentially just turn scripture into self-serving bullshit, right? I mean, like, it's less principled theologically to say, oh, no, that's not what was meant in the Bible. Like, now you're bringing what you hope it means or wish it meant, and you're doing your theology from there and not acknowledging that, no, you're actually just changing what's in scripture. So I respect religious fanatics for their honest fanaticism, right? So that I think came through in the conversation. It's like the thing that I never found myself annoyed by him, right? I mean, there's something very scary about his worldview, but the fact that he would represent it honestly, I had to do a little work. I mean, there were a few moments where he tried to not obfuscate, but at least elide the full implication of what he was suggesting is true or real or part of his worldview. But he just, you know, it just took another question or two to expose the fact that, yeah, he doesn't have an argument against chattel slavery. You know, we could bring that back in the U.S. and that would be biblical, and all things considered, probably more biblical than its abolition. I can deal, you know, I know where I stand with someone like that, but it's the moderate whose beliefs are infinitely elastic, who's so agile at lying to themselves that they don't even know when they're lying to anyone else. I find that more frustrating. I've always found that more frustrating. So,
yeah, but there was something so authentic and sweet about him, and the contrast of how the way he was talking with the words that he was saying. And you're right, it was sort of.
It's sweet, but this disjunction is scary, right? I mean, he's someone who can anticipate a time and work, you know, avidly toward such a time as it will be not just permissible, but it will simply be the case that under the right circumstances, people will be killed for gathering sticks on the Sabbath, or, you know, kids will be sent to the authorities to be butchered for having talked back to their parents in precisely the way you can't, you know, whatever that way is. And that's, I think at one point I created an example that just was a kind of super stimulus of blasphemy. But I mean, yes, under this worldview, if your daughter goes off to yoga class and wants to become a Hindu and chant her devotion to Shiva on the weekends, and you just start and reveals that she's a lesbian, et cetera, stack those entirely normal modern enthusiasms on top of one another, and you get a killing offense almost instantly, any way you look at it under his worldview. It was tempting to add a little topspin in my condemnation of all of that, but once I got into the conversation, I realized, no, actually, we can just talk about it sort of with an anthropological interest and let the audience do what it does, you know.
Right. Another follow-up question related to this. Would you have a conversation with a far-left person like the one you had with Doug Wilson, one where you simply probe their beliefs and push where there seem to be inconsistencies or mistakes, but without the need to fully debate? For whatever reason, it feels like you are less able to do that with liberals than you are with conservatives.
Yeah, I mean, I am less able to do that because I'm a liberal, right? Like, we share all of the same ethical intuitions. I mean, that's why I find someone like Ezra Klein, who's going to count up the number of black and brown people on my podcast and attack me, you know, as a racist for not having enough of them, and then say he's not attacking me as a racist, and then hit me over the head with Ibram X. Kendi. I find that just, like, again, it's much harder to deal with, right? It's the bad faith problem, right? There was nothing bad faith about Doug Wilson, right? I mean, like he's just, certainly nothing that I detected. It depends on the person. I'm sure I could bring on a committed socialist, right, who I just think is wrong on their economics and politics, and we could have a fine conversation. I could just walk them through the kind of world they want to live in, and they could tell us how they want, you know, to nationalize all the businesses, and they don't think billionaires should exist, and they want, they think the communist project, say, is still reclaimable. I could put that in front of an audience as a kind of intellectual and moral curiosity and not feel like I'd have to go to war. But I think the questioner is asking more about the Ezra Klein types, right? And that's been much harder because, yeah, our politics and our political and ethical goals are, you know, 95% in harmony. So, yeah.
More Epstein files have been released. Mm-hmm. Other than Larry Summers calling Epstein his wingman or something similar, do you care? Does this change anything? Is there anything in there yet?
I haven't spent a lot of time looking. You know, I have to think that if there's something in there that really renders famous people culpable for sharing in his crimes, we would have heard about it by now, but maybe that's a naive expectation.
There might be one more tranche coming, so yeah. I don't know. Maybe it's there.
But I feel like even under the Biden administration, it would be, I don't know. I mean, if I had to bet, I think, you know, Democrats and Republicans are implicated sort of equally, right? So I think both sides had reason to want to avert their eyes from it.
What Republicans are in there other than Steve Bannon?
Well, Donald Trump's in there.
I mean, he's not really, he is now, but he's not really anything, right?
What do you mean?
I mean, he's not really a Republican. He's not really anything. He's just, you know.
Well, he's a Republican now, yeah.
He's an actor.
I guess he was a Democrat, yeah, at the time.
Yeah.
No, I think there are Republicans who must be in there because, I mean, he certainly played both sides of the aisle. But I don't know. I mean, I've never thought that this was an interesting conspiracy. I mean, I think he almost certainly killed himself. And the fact that the cameras weren't working is not a terrible surprise. I mean, it's like how functional do you think the AV tech is over at Rikers Island? I mean, I just don't think it's far-fetched to think that he would have killed himself looking at the prison experience he was looking at. So I don't have a taste for conspiracy. It's not that all conspiracy theories are false, but they're so often explained by just how ramshackle the world really is. You know, it just, things break, people don't do their jobs well, people oversleep, you know, people are drunk, people are distracted. I mean, it's just bad shit happens due to incompetence all the time. I mean, it's just not the idea that someone figured out how to get this guy killed inside a jail when he didn't want to be killed, and no one knows how, and no one even knows about it now. Nothing's leaked, right? His lawyers didn't detect this problem. No guard has sung to 60 Minutes. I mean, it's like 9/11 truth conspiracy stuff. It makes absolutely no sense. And the people who have even 5 minutes for it, I just don't understand them. Again, it's not that there's never been a conspiracy. I'm sure people have been assassinated in the most clever possible ways, but I doubt this is one of those situations.
Did you see Megyn Kelly getting ripped over her comments for distinguishing between teenagers and children?
Yeah. I mean, it just, again, Megyn has been on a bit of a journey. I think she's said some things that I wouldn't want to defend of late, but yeah, strikes me as totally innocuous and an obvious distinction. And it's a distinction without an important difference in this case. I mean, the guy, it's not like she was saying he isn't criminally culpable for sexual assault and abusing girls and shouldn't be in jail. And I mean, or that he was a good person. I mean, she wasn't saying defending any of that. She was just saying I didn't watch this. I just have secondhand information about what she said. But my understanding is that she's just making the obvious distinction that a guy who's into 15-year-olds is different than a guy who's into 5-year-olds. And we all know this. And it's just a fundamentally different social phenomenon, right? You know, like every guy knows what it's like to be into, every heterosexual man knows what it's like to have been into 15-year-olds because he was once a 15-year-old, right? And had a 15-year-old girlfriend, presumably, or, you know, or wanted one. So it's just like, and the people who know what it's like to be into 5-year-olds are a very different sort of person, right? And if she was just saying that, sounds like she would have been effectively canceled for that, like she was for her blackface comments from NBC or whatever, whichever network canceled her. You know, it shows you that, yeah, it helps to be independent. If you're Megyn Kelly, there's no question.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I like Megyn Kelly. I really hope she can figure out her a way to call Tucker out. So and some of the other stuff she's been doing.
Yeah, I mean that's the thing. Megyn has. Again, she's always been entirely fair to me, and I've noticed and appreciated it. I mean, she's and she was fair in a moment when she would not have been incentivized at all to have been fair. And I saw, you know, former friends or friends who became former friends fail this test. You know, this is around the whole Hunter Biden laptop thing. I mean, she did a little tightrope walk in front of her audience on my behalf over that, and really seemed impeccable there. So, I think she's capable of being impeccable on all these other topics. I don't know why. Again, she's, I think, suffering some kind of audience capture over there to not want to differentiate herself from Tucker and Candace more clearly. Or maybe she's just, you know, maybe she's going through what I've gone through and talked about, which is feeling the friction of having a friendship or what seemed like a friendship with somebody who's got a huge public platform, whose brain goes totally fucking haywire, and then you are dealing with what you need to say or not say in front of your own audience about that, right? So she's probably really friends with Tucker, right? So how slow is she going to be to acknowledge that he's a super spreader of truly toxic ideas? She might be slower than anyone would want her to be.
Yeah. And while we're getting hated for half your audience for talking nicely about Megan, maybe we can get hated by the other half for talking about Don Lemon. Have you followed what he's doing on
no,
socials?
Unfortunately not.
He's phenomenal. He's at he's in his element. I have to tell you, I so enjoy watching whenever he pops up on Instagram. He's really so enjoyable. And getting fired from CNN is probably the best thing, again, that happened to him too.
Right. Right. Yeah. Really? Well, I have not seen it because I'm never on Instagram. I only see what you send me on Instagram. So if you want me to see Don Lemon, you're going to have to send it.
I will. But half the time I send you something, something else populates. Can they figure that out?
That's incredible. That's true. I when you send me something, I am often left wondering whether that's what you intended to send because it populates something else.
Yeah.
So. Yeah.
And other people that are great, Tim Miller and Sarah Longwell, I know you're fans of theirs, and they're going to be coming up on the podcast in a few weeks. Do you anticipate any daylight between you guys for that conversation or any?
I would be surprised. I mean, I mean, they're so deep in the weeds of politics and all the chaos right of center that, you know, I would just expect they're just going to be educating me on what's actually happening over there. I mean, I spend far too much time paying attention to it myself, but it's nothing compared to what those guys do. So, I mean, they might be more worried or less worried about certain things than I am, but the valence of our concern is identical.
Okay, it's time for the lightning round. You know what that means, Sam.
Yeah.
Okay, first question. Much of your work dismantles comforting illusions. What's one illusion you still suspect you're living inside but haven't been able to see clearly?
Well, the first that comes to mind is that parenting matters. Right, that the kind of parent you are really has a durable effect on the character and interests and competence of your children, that their life trajectory is importantly different for all the love and concern and assistance and attention you are disposed to direct their way. As far as I know, the research suggests that that's just not true. Right, that basically you gave them your genes and a life circumstance that hopefully didn't entail doing massive damage to them and blocking their progress in all kinds of normal ways. So, you know, you didn't deprive them of food or abuse them. But if you give them anything like a normal opportunity in life, the rest doesn't seem to matter in the way you would expect.
And how does that change the way that you're parenting?
Well, not at all. That's why I'm still in the grip of the illusion. I mean, one could argue it shouldn't change the way you're parenting, because the reason to be engaged and to shower them with love and attention and help and is not simply to improve them or to improve their life prospects. It's because that's the rewarding relationship you want to have with your kids, right? So you love your kids. You want to experience that with your kids. You want them to know it, and you want them to love you. You want as rich and as fun an experience as you can have with your family. So that's the reason to do it. But I think most parents are still taken in by the illusion that it really matters for who their kids become, right? And again, correct me if I'm wrong, the audience, but my understanding is that the behavioral genetics / psychology literature does not support that, right? And so it is with schools, right? Like, does it really matter that your kids get into a good school? Not really.
So you're you're taking your daughter to a Sabrina Carpenter concert?
Yeah, that's for this. That's right, exactly.
Nothing?
Yes.
How was that concert? I have to tell you, when I watched the video that you shared of you being on the floor videotaping that concert or recording it, that was incredible. I think we're going to have to put that up on
the people show that clip. The sacrifices we make for our kids, that's they hopefully matter. Yeah, they matter somewhere. Yeah.
Yeah. Do you guys celebrate Christmas at home?
Yeah. Yeah. Because it's the fun holiday. Yeah.
It's your favorite holiday of the year?
I like Halloween too. But yeah, I mean, I like Christmas. Christmas has always been fun. And obviously for kids, I think it's more fun than the alternatives. So yeah.
Speaking of kids. Yeah. And just if you can remind everybody about your position on Santa.
Well, I just think it's strange to think that Christmas wouldn't be fun unless you rigged it with the lie that Santa really exists or might really exist. No one feels that way about Halloween. Arguably, Halloween could be a little more fun if people thought that witches were real, right? But no one tends to tell that lie, and it's certainly fun enough, right? So I just don't think, I can assure you that Christmas is not deprecated in its significance if children know that it's parents taking all this time to wrap presents and buy everything on the list and et cetera, as opposed to elves and Santa, right? It's just not a problem. When you think about what it's like to be the last kid in third grade or whatever grade it is where kids start to get disabused of this fantasy, you don't want to be the last kid believing in Santa, right? That's just embarrassing, right? So do you want to be the second kid who doesn't believe in Santa? I mean, would you pick your moment where you want the epiphany to land for your kid? But you want to be early, as far as I can tell.
Well, it's way better as a parent to have the invisible babysitter of Santa, and mm-hmm. you get to, you know, tell your kids. I think it's just much more impactful. We don't do that, but I know plenty of people that do.
Right.
Your favorite Christmas movie?
I actually like A Christmas Carol with George C. Scott. Whenever, I forget when that was, like 1980 or 84. I forget when that was. It was actually, I think it was a television movie, but I think George C. Scott just growling through the Scrooge role. I think that's the most fun Christmas movie from my point of view.
Scrooge was pretty good, I think, do you ever see the one with Bill Murray, Scrooge?
Yeah, I think, part of it, yeah.
The best one has to be Bad Santa. You've seen that one, right?
I don't know if I've seen Bad
Billy
Santa.
Billy Bob Thornton. Holy crap, it's so good.
Yeah, no, I don't
know.
Oh,
it's laugh out loud. No. It's so inappropriate. No. I don't know if they can make that movie again today. You ever shed a tear while watching a Christmas movie or any of those memories?
I'm sure that's possible. Like, I can't.
Are you a Hallmark movie fan?
I can't remember it, but I do tear up easily in movies. I mean, it's not not hard, but I can't remember a specific Christmas movie.
Okay, on to the next question. I find myself missing your more fiery discussions and disagreements at times. I understand they may not always be pleasant for you, but they're certainly entertaining. Any consideration of doing those again?
Yeah, well, it just depends on the topic and the possible guest. I mean, I'm not avoiding them. It's just this kind of a Venn diagram of interesting, important topic and the right guest who might produce that conversation. Well, we're going to have Ross Douthat on the podcast. I don't know. It's not going to be a fiery disagreement, but obviously we disagree about some rather fundamental things. I mean, he's just written a book about the necessity of religious belief. Well, I think we're going to disagree, so we'll just see where that goes. But it's not that I'm avoiding it. It's the pointless wheel spinning and bad faith that I like to avoid. The person who's not being honest about the claims they're making or why they're making them, or I can't find myself on the other side of the table from, you know, another so-called liberal who can't figure out what's wrong with the Taliban. Like, there's just so much brain damage incurred by those collisions. And I mean, I could think of the right-wing equivalent too. It's just, I'm much more interested in talking honestly about the consequences of ideas and finding someone who will do that from whatever, you know, represent whatever divergent opinion is of interest to engage. But it's the unacknowledged hypocrisy and moral confusion that's just, it's very hard to deal with, you know.
I once heard you say, I like your framing around conversations versus debates and why you preferred conversations these days versus debates. Do you recall what you'd said there?
Yeah, I mean, I know why that's like. I mean, first of all, I mean, anything that's set up as a debate is being set up to fail as a conversation, right? It's not really a conversation because both parties come into the contest thinking of it as a contest, and You know, it's like it is like a tennis match. I mean, you know your job is to hit the ball in one direction only, and you're never going to diverge from that, right? Whether you succeed or fail, your intent is just you have to get the ball over the net no matter what. That's not the way conversation works. The conversation admits of the possibility at every moment that the game is going to change, right? That you're going to suddenly be aligned with the person, you know, who you disagreed with a moment ago. And you're going to be on the same team, at least for this part of the conversation, acknowledging that the good point he or she just made and the way it's actually just changed your opinion. And, you know, gratitude is the right response there. I mean, it's a completely different dynamic. And I mean, I'm much more interested in that because I'm much more interested in pressure testing my own views and acknowledging when they change and not just putting a brave face on my confusion and ignorance, despite the fact that it's being revealed in real time in a debate, right? I mean, and that's the thing that's so frustrating about debate. Nobody ever taps out. Nobody ever acknowledges that they were wrong. They should have known something or believed something different. They just change the topic or they light some other small fire that you have to put out or ignore and seem to ignore and therefore have that count against you. I mean, the fact that it's a game and not an honest exchange of ideas is what is annoying about debate.
Right. Plus, you miss out on having your mind changed, which should be the ultimate.
Yeah.
If somebody can persuade you and help you learn something new, that would be great.
Yeah.
And that doesn't exist in debate. How do you feel about medical suicide?
That's a funny transition. I mean, I think it should be available. I think it should be uncontroversial. And I mean, I think people should be mindful of the ways in which bad incentives or confusion can enter into this process. And we should want to have a protocol that guards against all that, right? I mean, like, take the obvious case, you know, someone is going to be bankrupted by their medical bills, and therefore they feel the need to commit suicide so as to preserve the inheritance of their family. I mean, that's just kind of a ghastly, you know, forced choice that we don't want people to have to confront, right? So, but that just suggests that there's a deeper solution that is required, that people, you know, people shouldn't be bankrupt by medical emergencies. But generally speaking, if you just imagine the pure case of someone's in intolerable pain or suffering, or some combination of the two, and they really want to get off the ride. And the question is, should we make that, you know, as painless and compassionate a possibility as we can, or should we prevent that based on some sort of Christian pseudo-ethic that it's an abomination in the view of God or the rest of the universe to end this agony sooner than it naturally does, right? It naturally ends. I mean, that seems to be the bias in most people's minds, right? That there's some virtue in letting nature resolve this issue. Well, nature is not compassionate at all. I mean, nature does not have even the slightest concern for human suffering, yeah. Right?
Ask bears.
Nature has created a circumstance where, you know, if flies can breed maggots in your wounds, in your last hours of life, it will do that quite happily, right? So you just have to think of what medicine was like before we had anything like modern medicine, and that's what nature has in store for you. So we should all be very grateful for the medicine we have and the analgesics we have, and we should want that armamentarium to grow. Do you mean true painkillers? I mean, painkillers that really worked in a way that would be precise and not clouding of a person's awareness or intelligence. I mean, that would be the Nobel Prizes that should be won by the first people who deliver that, should it be pharmacologically possible. I mean, that's a breakthrough we're all waiting for. But short of that, yeah, the people get into situations where, yeah, it's totally rational to want to end it. And we should understand.
Is there any policy that's too liberal for you there?
Well, yeah. I mean, a policy that is not taken into account, you know, untreated depression or the bad incentives of the sort that I just described. I mean, it's just we need a protocol that makes sure that people aren't stumbling into the process or being forced into it by kind of ill-considered motives. There's definitely a set of circumstances for which I think the decision to end your life makes perfect sense, and the agency for that should be compassionately provided. But there are definitely failure modes to that protocol that we have to be aware of.
Next question, as a reminder, we're in the lightning round. Oh, yeah. The current mayors of New York and London are seemingly liberal in their politics. It feels conspiratorial to cast aspersions about both men's faith being symptomatic of an Islamic takeover. However, it seems notable that these two great Western liberal cities are now led by Muslims. What are your thoughts on this?
Well, I don't know how much kind of Muslim identity politics has corrupted the thinking of either of these two mayors. To say that it hasn't at all seems a little far-fetched. I can't imagine that either would be capable of an honest discussion of the sort that I would want to have about the unique challenges that Islam presents to open societies, right? I would no sooner get to the end of a sentence like that that it would trip their Islamophobia alarms, which won't be a surprise to my audience. I consider to be purely evasive bullshit, right? I mean, I just think it's, if you can't acknowledge that there are unique concerns around Islam, you're just not even in the game, honestly, at all in talking about the relevant politics and social dynamics. So, you know, like how, take me out of it, how a conversation between someone like Ayaan Hirsi Ali and one of these guys would go, I think it would be all too predictable for them to just refuse to have a conversation with someone like her and in her absence, call her a right-wing bigot and Islamophobe. So I think that's, given that I expect that to be the center of gravity for them. So I think it's not good. We have a certain flavor of religious bamboozlement and identity politics operating there where we should just want reason, compassion, and real ethics and, you know, real defense of open societies and liberal principles and all of that, right? So he's going to be, I guarantee you, Mamdani would have seen nothing wrong with a Ground Zero mosque, nothing wrong with the expressions of Islamist and jihadist triumphalism the world over that would have greeted that mosque. No special culpability for the doctrine of Islam for the events of September 11th. And anything, you know, even a shade otherwise is Islamophobia. If I could walk into a casino and place a bet on that, I would jump off this podcast and do that immediately without knowing any more about what Mamdani has said on this topic.
So today we ran a poll online to see how your fans viewed you relative to them politically. Any guesses on what percentage viewed you to the right versus the left of them?
Where was this poll run?
We did it on YouTube, Instagram, and Substack.
Huh, interesting. I didn't know you were doing this.
We did it like 2 hours ago. Just curious.
And how many people replied?
Thousands. Huh. Many thousands.
It's very interesting. I don't have a strong intuition. I would think that they think I'm a little to the right of them. That's what I'm guessing.
So you're right. On YouTube, 48% thinks you're to the left and 52% thinks you're to the right. On Instagram, 49% to the left.
Wow, it's close.
51% to the right. Very close. On Substack, 58% thinks you're to the right and 42% to the left.
It's still pretty close. I mean, I love the hair's breadth closeness of the first two.
Right.
That's really great. And that's a great audience. Yeah.
Yeah, it's right there.
Yeah.
Okay, last question. This is sort of, I guess, keeping in mind for Thanksgiving, although we did talk a lot about Christmas. Maybe this is the last episode of More From Sam that we'll have before Christmas. But we're living in a moment where polarization often makes good faith conversation feel impossible. Even when two people want to communicate honestly, identity, moral intuitions, and tribalism can get in the way. What do you think are the most effective ways to structure a conversation or cultivate the right inner posture so that disagreement becomes a path toward understanding rather than conflict? And again, I'm framing this toward many people going home for Thanksgiving when every family's got one. Sam, do you have one in your family?
Well, as you know, I have them in the close circle of friends. I do not have a Trumper in my family. No, so.
Well, to everybody, everyone's got one or got someone. And
I have
far
left action in my family, but not who I will see over Thanksgiving. But well, I mean, I think you definitely have to distinguish face-to-face conversation from anything that might happen by text. You know, so what can get out of hand in a WhatsApp thread or some text-based communication, I think does not get out of hand in the same way face-to-face. It's not to say that things can't go off the rails face-to-face, but it's worth noticing that, you know, the kind of road rage phenomenon that you can get texting is not something you're getting face-to-face. And that I think you should consider what's happening face-to-face to be more real than what's happening by text. And I think those guardrails are important.
But is there a story you can tell yourself so that, you know, when you're walking in compassion or I love these people. Can you say it three times before you walk in? Mm-hmm. I want to hear them out.
It's worth, you know, count. It's worth remembering. Yeah. It's worth remembering that you love these
count
people.
Count 3 seconds before you do anything or respond. Is there some posture going into that that can be helpful? Because I've seen blowups in real life at these types of family events.
Well, yeah, I mean, but it's also good to unpack what you mean by loving these people. I mean, you actually want them to be happy, right? You want them to not suffer. You want their dreams realized. And it's pretty easy when things start going off the rails. Certainly, in some cases, you can notice the life dissatisfaction that is giving it energy on the other side. I mean, it's not. I mean, it may be true on your side as well. But so, like, both parties are bringing their pain to the conversation. But you know, so assuming things are going well for you, you know, you can notice that in many cases people are advertising their discomfort, you know, the many flavors of their discomfort and dissatisfaction in how they're engaging these kinds of topics, right? And I think you can just give a little more space for that and become less reactive and less judgmental. And I do think people should pick their battles for many of these things, because it's just not, you know, is it important that you really resolve, you know, the war in Gaza at Thanksgiving with this uncle, right? Probably not. You know, the war in Gaza is going to resolve itself, however it does, if it's not resolved already, with or without you. So, yeah, I just think there's something wise about deciding whether you really want to dig in on these kinds of topics with this person in that moment. And the answer is, more often than not, I think no. I don't think you want to declare defeat across the board in your most important relationships, but it is impressive how little progress there is to make face to face when you're both getting, you know, wrapped around the axle of some hot controversy and you're on different sides of it. Like, the diminishing returns, you should tune your diminishing returns detector to greater sensitivity and then just get off the ride sooner.
All right. Well, good luck, everybody at home, and enjoy your Thanksgiving. Happy Thanksgiving. I want to thank everyone again who submitted questions. If you'd like to help with the show in the future, you can head over to Sam's Substack page and submit questions and participate in the online community there. That's it once again for this episode. Again, happy Thanksgiving, everyone. And for those not in America, happy, what is it, third or fourth week of November? I don't know.
Yeah. Third, yeah. Or fourth. What is it?
Fourth. I don't know. Yeah. I haven't looked at it. I don't know what it is. Anyway, happy November 25th to 26th or 27th, whenever this comes out.
Yeah, fourth. Yeah, thanks for listening.
No, it is the 25th.
Yeah.
I think it is.
We're at the end.
This
end of November, no doubt.
Oh, it's the fourth week. Fourth week. Sorry, that's what you're saying. I got it. Okay, well, bye, everybody, if you're still listening. I'm sorry. See you next time.